Welcome to The Remedy, brought to you by NYC Health and Hospitals. Innovating public health care to benefit all New Yorkers.
Hey, it's Michael Shen. Every New Yorker deserves to live a healthy life, and access to great healthcare is closer than you might think. The job of providing healthcare to all of New York City is a massive task. Everyone who works at NYC Health and Hospitals understands that responsibility. But the weight of that pressure, coupled with long hours and challenging situations, can often lead to stress and burnout, impacting the mental health of frontline healthcare workers. So our theme today, helping healers heal. Today, I'm joined by two guests, Dr. Eric Wei, Senior Vice President and Chief Quality Officer for NYC Health and Hospitals, and Jeremy Siegel, our System Chief Wellness Officer. Together, we're going to be discussing how NYC Health and Hospitals is supporting the mental health of more than 40,000 healthcare workers. Eric, Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
Michael, it's truly a pleasure and congratulations on the success of this podcast.
Thanks so much for being here. Eric, it's no secret that being a healthcare worker, as we are, for the nation's largest public healthcare system, can be a very stressful job. And that's why you created Helping Healers Heal, or otherwise known as H3. Can you tell us about how the program started and what you were hoping to address?
Yeah, absolutely. Would love to. So this story actually starts in Los Angeles, and I was brand new as the deputy CMO for quality and safety there. And one of the roles I was asked to take on was to facilitate root cause analysis. So these are the meetings that we look at opportunities to learn from our toughest cases to fix the system and prevent recurrence from happening. But every time I left one of these meetings, I'd have this pit at the bottom of my stomach. We would bring frontline residents, attending physicians, nurses to the verge of tears, sometimes to actual crying. And then after an hour and a half meeting, we would pat them on the back and say, let's go back to the ICU and hand out meds perfectly. Let's go to the operating room and do surgery perfectly. And I knew, and they knew, and everyone in the room knew that they couldn't do that. They were compromised at that point. And it was a little bit of a culmination of my personal observations and myself and my colleagues in residency. Everyone had their tough months, right, where they felt burnt out or felt depressed, right? And so all of this came together. Wow, we need to be doing something different. We could do better for each other. And so that's when I started reading and reaching out to folks. And I learned about Dr. Susan Scott, the patient safety officer at University of Missouri. She had started this program called the For You Team to address something I never heard of, but it really resonated with me with my own stories, was this concept of second victim. When something happens in healthcare, either because of natural etiologies or because of an error, obviously the patient, the family, they are the people most impacted. But healthcare workers are also human, and they also accrue emotional and psychological trauma from these cases. So the idea is that they are considered the second victim. And so finding people who shared this feeling of, wow, we give patients and families our healing powers day in and day out, but somehow the house of medicine, the culture was one where we weren't allowed to give it to each other, turning towards our colleagues and our peers. We got to figure out how to do something different about changing the culture. And so it was kind of this groundswell, bringing interested folks. There were people on the Department of Pediatrics and the Department of OBGYN and patient safety, quality, leadership. And we created this committee. It was like, we're going to build something like the For You team here. But we basically decided nobody wants to be second and nobody wants to be a victim. So we can't call it the second victim program. And so as we were building the parts to this, we did a naming contest. We bought an iPad. We put it out to the staff of LA County USC, come up with the name and you win this iPad. And so that's how we came up with Helping Healers Heal on the H3 program. But really proud of how this program really resonated with the staff and grew rapidly within that hospital, and then was spread to the other hospitals in LA's safety net system. But in end of 2017, beginning of 2018, when Dr. Katz and I had agreed and decided to come here together, after the first set of meetings, he and I were debriefing over wonton soup in Chinatown, and he asked me how the meetings went. I was like, wow, New York City Health and Hospital staff could use H3 even more than LA could. And so that set us out on agreeing that this would be the first thing that I would work on and bring from LA to New York City. And I was very lucky that Jeremy Siegel just happened to be the director of performance improvement, had a licensed creative arts therapy background, and immediately knew that he would be my partner in kind of doing it in the opposite way, which is not from the bottom up, but coming in from the top down and saying, we need this everywhere across health and hospitals as soon as possible. And so that's the backstory.
Yeah, I like that it happened over wonton soup, which is also my wellness cure, I feel like. So, you know, I think the timing was really great for our healthcare workers in our system. This happened in 2018 when you brought it to our system. And then soon thereafter, COVID hit. And of course, we all went through the pandemic and it was a wild time. A lot of stress, workloads were very high. Can you tell me a little bit about how you saw helping healers heal have that impact during the pandemic?
Yeah, I'll start and I'll hand off to Jeremy to talk a little bit more about this because he played the quarterback for how this exploded during COVID-19 pandemic here in New York City to step up to play and meet the need at the time. So we felt very lucky that we had those 2 years from 2018 to the beginning of 2020 to stand up 18 Helping Healers Heal teams with their own leadership, with their own steering committee, with their own trained peer support champion, kind of army of peer support champions that could respond for one-on-one and group debriefs. So we were well positioned. And another piece that helped us going into the pandemic was our Office of Behavioral Health. We provide over 60% by volume of the admissions for behavioral health in New York City as just one system. And so we have the most amazing psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. And so they were a great partner in not only just standing up Helping Healers Heal, but responding together, H3 and OBH together to meet what came to our shores in the March of 2020. And Jeremy could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of the culture of workforce wellness was already in motion. So it wasn't just about what we would call an H3 or Helping Healers Heal encounter, which is a group or individual debrief. We started to change some of the interventions themselves as well, knowing that our doctors, our nurses, our patient transporters, our environmental service workers, food and nutritionists, psychotherapists, right, were all called to duty and couldn't necessarily sit down for a lot of time to potentially process and reflect, although we were encouraging that. That's what gave birth to proactive unit-based wellness rounds. So ways that we could collect information to do service recovery, to be able to check the climate of how people are doing and to further share resources gave birth to that. And since the onset of the pandemic, we have had 40,966 wellness rounds to date, launching in March of 2020. In addition to the wellness rounds, we were doing something called wellness events. What we realized is that at times, the experience was tough to talk about. And was there something that we could do to aesthetically distance some of the content, the information, in a way that was safe psychologically for staff to process if they didn't want to speak? And so that's what gave birth to what we call our wellness events. And wellness events were facilitated by licensed creative arts therapists, social workers, psychologists, anyone that was willing to use the healing powers in different art mediums or specific events to be able to take their mind off of COVID itself, but to project it onto something else. And to date, we've had 4,486 wellness events. What we also did was to make sure that there was respite, so some form of reprieve and rejuvenation, to take time off of the floors, to allow the staff and to encourage the staff to connect to their own concrete needs. And that's what gave birth to our wellness rooms. At the peak of the pandemic, we had 31 wellness rooms open across the acute and post-acute service lines. But now to date, we have 20 permanent wellness rooms that were just recently upgraded, aesthetics designed by, with, and for the staff themselves. The staff saying, how exactly do we want to use a wellness room, and partnering with WXY Studios, the support of philanthropic donations, we've been able to design 20 upgraded wellness rooms that will now be a permanent fixture on the plants of our campuses, knowing that space is a commodity these days, but our system is really supportive of wellness for our system. We also, unfortunately, had to do morning spaces and things of that nature. In addition to that, we did visual and auditory management. So how could we support the visual aspects of our facilities? How could we play a song when a patient that was admitted that we really didn't think was going to make it through their COVID illness was discharged, so that we would brighten the spirits? And these were just a few ways that we had well positioned ourselves as a system to be able to use the original helping healers heal, but to really transform it over time. So now H3 is inclusive of trauma, stress on a continuum. It's also just all about burnout, compassion fatigue, and just the general healthcare experience. And it isn't just about crisis, because we don't want to medicalize well-being, but it's also about celebrating successes and just opening a different kind of dialogue with each other.
I think that what does become difficult is that oftentimes we hear about wellness and well-being and all of that in the media. It tends to be a buzzwordy type thing. When it comes down to it, there is a lot of stigma around all of these deep issues. It's hard for healthcare workers who feel like their job is to always be around, to go to the max for people, to actually take a break and step out for themselves. And I was kind of wondering how you think about that stigma and how we've tried to address the difficulty of opening up and coming out about what you're going through.
Well, there are two main barriers to well-being. Number one is stigmatization, societal stigmatization, so universal ways that we look at and minimize, and also, again, look at well-being as a bad thing, that if you use wellness services, you are less than, you are weak, you are incompetent, you're not fit for duty. This will be used against you in the court of public opinion or against licensure or credentialing. So stigma is the number one barrier to people seeking support services, especially when they need it the most. And the second barrier is just lack of awareness of what is even available. Stigmatization, and I can pass this to Eric, obviously as a physician himself, is leading to a statistic that is unfortunately quite staggering, that we are still losing one doctor a day to death by suicide because of the silent stoic culture of the houses and schools of medicine. Still to this day, female identifying physicians are 2.27 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population. And if you're a male identifying physician, you are 1.41 times more likely to die by suicide. And the estimated cost associated to suicide and attempts, as stated by the America's Health Ranking Report, is about $93.5 billion to the healthcare industry. I don't know, Eric, obviously you've gone through a lot as a physician, and I'm sure it's been tough sometimes to actually share your own stories and to actually speak up when you saw a colleague in trouble or you yourself were having a tough day.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Jeremy. I think some of the things that get in the way is this culture of the house of medicine. There's a saying in nursing that the nurses eat their young. And on the physician side, you know, we all remember from residency, we had the attendings who didn't have duty hours and walked barefoot uphill on the snow both directions to the hospital and worked more hours than there are in the week. So what do we have to complain about for duty hours and all the wellness protections today? And so that was that culture I was getting at of almost like a rite of passage that we have to toughen you up and turn you into this non-human that is able to navigate the emotional and psychological trauma of working in healthcare, of losing patients, of losing colleagues and friends. And so I think some of the things that also contribute to that is the imposter syndrome. We're coming out of medical school, we're an intern, we look around and we're like, oh, these classmates are so much smarter than me. I don't know how I got in here, right? And then attendings and nurses and other specialties. And so if you already feel that way, are you going to come out and say, I think I made a mistake or I didn't do the best on this case, right? It's just contributing to that negative cycle in your head of I'm not good enough to be here. And then that turns into suffering alone, of negative thoughts, and then potentially becoming burnt out, jaded, of depression, of turning to substances, alcohol, dropping out of the field of medicine. And then my greatest nightmare, and Jeremy, I'm sure you share this as well, is losing another colleague or another peer, another friend in healthcare to dropping out of healthcare, or the worst possible is suicide. And so definitely Dr. Lorna Breen's death by suicide in early 2020 was a collective gut punch to all of us who work in healthcare, emergency medicine, and then care about workforce wellness in the wellness space. And so those were all extra whys of why we do this program.
Yeah, and I know that we have recently done a wellness survey to take a look at the temperature across the system. And Jeremy, I wonder if you could share some of those results.
Before we even talk about NYC Health and Hospitals survey, let's talk about a recent study that the CDC just published. They did a longitudinal study from 2018 to 2022. They had three control groups. One, healthcare workers across care settings, two, essential workers, including EMS and other first responders, and then all other industries, tech, food and beverage, things of that nature. And the findings are quite staggering. And so this is national data, but we have to have national data to then look at ourselves to say, what are our benchmarks? What are we looking at? And so 46% of healthcare workers right now on the CDC report are saying that they're burned out. 46% of all healthcare workers that are part of the CDC study. Two times, more than double the number of healthcare workers reported harassment at work in 2022 than 2018. Nearly half of healthcare workers, so 44%, intend to look for a new job or intended to in 2022. That was up from 33% in 2018. So turnover rates, the percentage for healthcare workers who intend to look for a new job, is surpassing other essential workers, first responders, and other industries. And right now, the part of the CDC report, which I think is most staggering, is that they are calling it a healthcare mental health crisis, where out of 30 days within one calendar month, healthcare workers reporting five poor mental health days. So what does that do in terms of morale, productivity, sick calls, people just fully leaving the industry at large, quiet quitting, the great resignation still existing, right? Especially for healthcare workers. So again, national data is out there. We're surveying people, but more importantly, what are you doing with that information? And how is that impacting how you work? And so we have surveyed the health and well-being of our staff 2020, 2021, and most recently in 2023. So in 2023, we had 51% of our staff take the survey. So one out of every two healthcare workers working for our system took it. And while we saw really great gains, if you will, we still have some work to do. So we were able to decrease stress by 55%, anxiety by 59%, compassion fatigue by 65%, feelings of sadness by 61%. But what I really want to talk about is the value crisis in the United States right now. The American Medical Association is reporting that one out of every two healthcare workers does not feel valued by their organization at all. And so what we have learned, as you heard Eric talk about at the top of today's conversation, is that it was a top-down approach because our staff needed to feel like they were valued, that they were important, that they mattered, and that they are the asset that they are, that is what keeps NYC Health and Hospitals running. And so in 2023, we were able from 2020 to increase how staff felt valued by 47%. And that's because they have support services that they actually feel listened to and cared for and are encouraged to care for themselves, knowing that we cannot take care of others if we are not actually encouraged to take care of ourselves. And the thing that we still have to work on, although this was a great gain for our system, we increased the amount of opportunities for staff to feel that they can de-stress while at work by 18%. It's still something we have to work on. We have to redefine stress. We have to redefine the triggers that bring it on and help people be able to understand that for themselves, but what they can do while at work, but also while at home.
I think, Michael, it comes back to this quote from J.W. Marriott that I absolutely love, and that's simplicity. He said, to essence, if you take care of your employees will take care of the customers and the business will take care of itself. And I think that's what we're getting at here. Our most precious resource in healthcare is our people. It's the people who are providing the healing. They're providing the magic of modern medicine to heal people from diseases, from conditions. And if they are not taken care of, if they're not bringing their best self because they don't have a full tank of energy, of empathy, not being burnt out, cognitive overload, they're not going to be able to give the high quality, the safe patient care with the great patient experience that we would want for ourselves, for our family members. And so all of this is about we should be investing in the well-being of our healthcare workers so that they can provide that high quality, safe care of the best experience.
And one thing that I mentioned wonton soup at the top of the episode, but I also really enjoy art. That's one of my outlets. And I know, and I hope we can do an episode on this at some point. As the public hospital system in New York, we have one of the largest art collections. And I know that art plays a role in a lot of our wellness programs. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Art and humanities definitely helped myself, the staff through the pandemic. And we were very lucky to have one of the largest municipal art collections dating back to the Great Depression, the WPA administration, and many of those murals still exist in our system. But Jeremy mentioned a little bit about how hospitals have always played a little lullaby when babies are born and everybody is like, oh, that's so cute. You take a moment to pause, new life just started. In our darkest days, we took that idea and said, why don't we have hospitals pick a song that represents hope, that represents healing, that they want played over the same PA system across the whole hospital every time somebody with COVID is extubated. And in the early days, it did not feel like anybody who went onto a ventilator would come off of it because it was so many weeks. And just seeing staff in their full PPE dancing, hugging, and showing signs of joy, something we hadn't seen in our hallways, in our healthcare environments, just shows a little bit of music, a little bit of humanities can bring that much joy. And I told my daughters, who were 3 and 5 at the time, that every time somebody plays a fight song, it's a Rachel Platten song that Jacoby and NCB had selected, somebody is healed of the virus or cured of the virus. And so they just stood next to Alexa for like every awake hour and they just said, Alexa, play fight song. Alexa, play fight song. Because they felt like they were healing somebody every time the song played. But our arts and medicine program is possible because of the Lori M. Tisch Illumination Fund. Lori Tisch herself and Rick Lufglass, their executive director, actually sought us out as new leadership of health and hospitals. Said, did you know you had this amazing municipal public art collection? The answer was no. Do you know that it's been neglected for decades because of the financial situation of health and hospitals? The answer was no. And they wanted to partner because the mission of this Illumination Fund is access to art. And what better alignment of missions than our access to healthcare as a right, you know, not a privilege. Without exception, we believe in high quality and safe care for everyone. And so bringing this investment, this philanthropic donation to build arts and medicine programming to leverage the collection, but also build new art, such as our community mural projects that we only briefly paused during COVID because we realized this was yet another tool to help staff process and heal, come together with focus groups of artists and talk about what kind of mural they would like to see in their hospital and their facility and have multiple focus groups leading to the artist creating a mural and then a joint paint party. So it's patients, community members, staff, all painting together before it goes up on the wall. And so one of our murals at Elmhurst Hospital is Elmhurst Strong. And it shows very dark, black and white, the beginning of the pandemic through all the things that are great about the Elmhurst area and Queens and very colorful and a rebirth almost. So very much created with COVID in mind there. But we do so many cool things from bringing in local musicians to play music for the soul. We do art observation for team building, communication skills. We even have artists come in and write lullabies for new moms. So they make their own lullabies. And then just using our art for healing environments. South Brooklyn Health just recently opened the new Ruth Bader Ginsburg Hospital. And one of the coolest units there is our behavioral health unit, because it's so different from every other behavioral health unit you might have seen in training and in your career, because it's such a healing environment. There's so many windows, so much light. You can't help but feel you're in a warm, healing place compared to very sterile environments.
That's really wonderful. I want to go visit. So to end our show, I kind of want to ask both of you, how do you manage stress in your own life? How do you decompress and relax?
What I often say when speaking with direct clinical and non-clinical teams is share your story, because your coping strategy or your coping mechanisms could become someone else's survival guide. So I think it's also important not just to say what's working, but when it hasn't worked and how you recovered, how you came through, how you found support within yourself and within the community around you, or how you asked for help. So before I tell you what I do to actually decompress, I'd rather tell you when I wasn't doing it. So September 2021, that's when I really started to process everything that had really just gone on with the onset of the pandemic. And while it still wasn't behind us and still isn't, I completely lost sight of myself and fell off my own to-do list. So as I'm parading around the system and I'm at sites every single week, I'm doing wellness events, retreats, I'm doing the work, not just talking about it or strategizing around it. And so I'm teaching others how to communicate about their well-being needs and what we could help unearth so that they could connect to for themselves. And while I'm doing this, I was the most unwell chief wellness officer that ever existed. I had completely not taken care of my physical health. as someone with diabetes. I quit therapy because it was just too overwhelming to really face the experiences that I had, what I was processing, all the trauma I was holding. Socially, I started to isolate myself. I, at that time, and still am, married. And I was starting to argue with my spouse more, who was a great partner and champion of me and with me throughout the pandemic, helping me with just meals while I worked 17, 18 hour days back to back. And just it became this unfortunate snowball where I started to become very apathetic. And even though I put on a great face at work and I was able to smile and teach others about well-being, I wasn't feeling it for myself. And it got to the point where I started to question, who am I? What's my meaning and purpose? I lost sight of the thing that I love the most, which is to help heal others and to help develop others so that they can care for patients. So what really helped me and what I still do to this day is I make sure that I am exercising. And if I can't get to the gym, what is a mindful or micro wellness intervention that I could do just to say I showed up for myself that day? And so often, and my teams know this, I'll get off the subway stop before my actual stop as I'm rushing off to clinical practice after a long day's work. But that extra 15 minutes of walking is me saying I did it for myself. Not taking the elevator and actually walking up 7 flights of stairs is me saying that's wellness. Wellness is not a destination. It's a journey. It's not an outcome. It's a process. So daily, intentionally choosing it for yourself. Maybe I will have a reward meal, but tomorrow, what's my wellness in terms of my food intake, my sleep hygiene, psychotherapy? We have an employee assistance program, and I'm trying to talk openly about how I have used NYC Health and Hospital's employee assistance program and that I'm in psychotherapy because why not? And show others that it's okay at times to not be okay, but it's not okay to not be okay alone. And so if you don't feel comfortable speaking to others or even sharing it with your most close loved ones, can you speak to someone privately? And so it's about connection to others so that in a way they can become the mirror to reflect back on you. Wellness is how we pay it forward. The way I finally stopped myself from this downward spiral was because about 3 months earlier, I asked my staff member, what color are you on the stress continuum, which is a 4-color continuum that we learned from the U.S. Department of Defense. And they were orange that day. And so by just teaching them how to have a conversation around a color of the stress level they were, they in turn turned back to me 3 months later and said, what color are you, Jeremy? And I said, red. And that was the beginning of me saying it out loud. And that is what made a difference and a change of how I started to take better care of myself. Dancing is also something I love. Music is something I love. And just remembering that at the end of the day, it's about community and that we can all rise together as a system, as a team, as a family, as a group of friends, or we can fall. And so it really is about the village that you keep around you.
I'll say that our small team asks each other for their colors during huddle, and that's something you taught us. So thanks for that. Eric, how do you manage stress?
Yeah, isn't it amazing how they say doctors make the worst patients? I guess Jeremy and I are like that. People working on wellness are the worst at identifying burnout and lack of well-being in ourselves. So similarly, I have a story from 2020, is August of 2020. So COVID reached our hospitals in March. So this was basically your engine redlining for 5 straight months, right? And it got so bad that I was meeting with my boss, Dr. Mitchell Katz, and he stopped me and he said, Eric, I don't want to see you for 2 weeks. I'm forcing you to take this time off. We'll meet again in 3 weeks when you come back. I didn't feel like I was burnt out or I didn't see it. And it wasn't until probably like 4 or 5 days into the first week, I'm like, oh my gosh, I was in such a bad place. And so thankfully, Mitch recognized that and called me out on it and then did something about it. But I realized it was all the things that bring me joy, that bring me balance, that center me. And I love the work that I get to do for New York City Health and Hospital. I feel like I found purpose in making a difference for the most vulnerable patient population. I get up every morning excited to come to work. It doesn't feel like work, but it is the family. It is the kids. No matter how stressful the day is, I open the door and like 3 people jump into my arms and are just so excited to see me, and everything else melts away, all the stress. But I wasn't able to have that. I was isolating. I had a newborn at home. We were scared about what COVID meant for him. And so I didn't get to hug. I didn't get to kiss. I didn't get to hold my children. I didn't get to be in the same space as my wife. We didn't have family visit us, which they always visit year round, our friends. And so that was something that was clearly missing. And then the other thing I realized is I always had something to look forward to on the calendar, whether it's a family trip or a friend visiting. The calendar was empty besides work. And so not having something to look forward to, right? No matter how hard it is, 2 more weeks and we're taking a vacation together, or so-and-so who I haven't seen in 3 years is coming to visit, and, right? We get to catch up. And so realizing that over those 2 weeks and being like, these are concrete steps that we can do going forward, prioritizing time with friends, family, always having something on the calendar to look forward to. But similar to Jeremy, right? I wasn't exercising. And so getting exercise and eating right, whether that be skiing, snowboarding, hiking, cycling. I just recently started doing these F45 workouts, you know, at 5 and 6 in the morning, but it just sets the day off on the right tone. And something that I recently added to my repertoire is meditation. And so somebody who works closely with us in the arts and medicine, the Illumination Fund, Jan Rothschild, actually taught me Vedic meditation, because she's like, you move to the suburbs, now you ride the train, it's about 30 minutes, that's perfect. You can meditate for 20 minutes in and out of the city, and it's just another tool on the tool belt to de-stress and center and be my best self as I get to work and be my best self as I get home, because it's a little bit of chaos with both.
Well, Eric, Jeremy, thank you so much for sharing, and thanks for the great conversation. It was great to have you.
Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have today. I want to say a big thank you again to Jeremy Siegel and Dr. Eric Wei for joining us on the show and discussing how NYC Health and Hospitals is helping healers heal. Thanks as well to you for listening. Please remember to leave a review and subscribe. I'm Dr. Michael Shen, and this has been The Remedy, brought to you by NYC Health and Hospitals. See you next time.
This podcast was produced by Amaze Media Labs.